supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. Spring has sprung, baseball season has begun, and that means we are all thinking about what kind of tomatoes we're going to be growing this year. So, later in the show, we will discuss two top topics of tomato growing. Should you prune suckers on a plant? And how can you explain when a bed suddenly becomes unproductive? We'll let you know what we think about those after lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ellie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Ellie. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I am just ducky. Thanks for asking. Where is Ellie very well?
Well, I live in Wellsboro, Pennsylvania.
And where is that?
That's in Tioga County.
Okay, so you're upstate.
I am very upstate. I am just below New York State, north central Pennsylvania.
Okay. All right. What can we do you for?
Well, about 2 years ago, my husband and I bought a log cabin outside of Wellsboro, and it's kind of on a ridge top. We have about 22 acres, lots of deciduous forest, and there is little to no landscaping. Basically, what we have is some very large rhododendron. We have some very sad leggy lilacs, and basically, my house is brown. And everything else is green, and I'm just looking for some ideas for landscaping that's relatively low maintenance that I can put around the house.
Well, it's interesting that the rhododendrons are doing well because they are typically understory plants, and you have an understory situation. I mean, you got a canopy over your whole place in the summertime, right?
Yeah, we probably get, well, I would say the woodline starts about 60 to 70 feet from the house on the east side. So we do get a couple hours of sunlight on that side of the house. The other side has a very large maple that basically shades everything.
Right.
So they do get a couple hours, but they're huge. I mean, they're like 10 feet tall. Maybe
exactly.
More.
This is the situation they love. It's so counterintuitive. Here's a plant that produces some of the biggest, most beautiful flowers and often produces hundreds, if not thousands, of them at the same time. And these are Native American plants that thrive in the shadow of the hardwood forests.
Mm-hmm.
You go up into the Smoky Mountains, there's acres of rhododendrons that you can't even walk in between. It's so tight. They've got like a suspended boardwalk for you to walk above the plants.
Yeah.
Just stunning. So you might want to add some azaleas in there. They're the same family as rhododendrons. They like the same conditions. I think the azaleas would do just as well as the rhododendrons.
Okay.
And there's a great variety of color in azaleas that you're not going to find in rhododendrons. But you need something later in the season. Now, I guarantee that your local master gardeners in your local extension office are probably going to have a whole set of bulletins on woodland plants that do well in the area. So I would contact both your Pennsylvania Extension and New York, because as you said, you're kind of on the cusp, and see what kind of plants are recommended for woodland settings, because there's going to be a lot of native plants in there that you'll be able to grow easily that other people don't, because oddly enough, they don't have these kind of conditions that hold back sun-loving plants, but are very kind to many native plants that grew up in your region. The other intruder, which is always part of the coward's shade garden, is hostas. By the summertime, my house is completely enveloped. I bought Snow White's old house in the woods, and you know, I got one area clear to grow tomatoes in a little bit. I lie to them and tell them they're shade-loving plants. But the front of my house gets very little sun, and hostas thrive there. Now, obviously, the regular old hostas just have straight green leaves, but the variegated hostas will have a lot of white striping in their leaves, a lot of white variegation. There may even be other variegated varieties. I think there's some with black in their leaves. So the leaves are very attractive, but even in the darkest shade, they are going to produce beautiful purple flowers in the summer, when typically very little else is in bloom in the area. the flowers, which are sequential, there'll be 10 or 12 individual flowers going straight up on each spike. The top of the spike may be 4 or 5 feet high. So you've got not only color, but it's up in the air. The hostas will thrive there. Your problem will be keeping them under control. But one of the nice things about planting a bunch of different varieties is the colors of the flowers will be slightly different. They'll all be purple, but the old established, the regular hostas, the vulgar hostas, they're a very deep purple. But the variegated ones are so light purplish in color. So you can really mix and match them very well. You'll love looking at the leaves. You'll get that color up high. And then your local extension services will be able to recommend some ground cover plants that'll be producing nice flowers for you in the summer as well.
Great.
All right. Good luck, Ellie.
Thank you very much. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Yep. Have a good day. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Cody, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I am just ducky today. Cody, how are you, sir?
Doing fantastic, especially getting a hold of you.
Okay. And where is Cody fantastic?
I am in Delaware, a little town called Marshallton.
Okay. And where is that in Delaware?
I'd say it's about 10 miles west of Wilmington.
Okay. Very good. What can we do you for?
So me and my fiance just bought our first place.
Congratulations.
Down there in that area. Thank you so much. And it's a great spot, although I can tell we were going to have quite a bit of a mosquito problem. And I was wondering if there's anything I could do to help that situation without having to spray. You know, I'd like to have some nice plants to help shoo them away, I guess.
Okay, none of that works. You can spray for mosquitoes temporarily. If you're like having an outdoor wedding, there's garlic oil-based sprays that you can spray around a backyard or a field that'll keep them away for like 30 days. But chemical sprays will kill the birds and the frogs and the toads and the dragonflies that would otherwise control them. And although everybody loved the ads, I don't see them anymore, the famous mosquito-repelling plant. There's no plant that repels mosquitoes sitting in a pot or in the ground. Any of the lemon-scented herbs, lemon thyme, lemon balm, the plant in those magazine ads was a lemon-scented geranium. Any of the lemon-scented herbs, when grown out and you crush the leaves up and rub them on your skin, they can be as effective as some concentrations of DEET, but you have to actually pick them and apply them to your skin. So why do you think you're going to have lots of mosquito problems?
Well, it seemed as though when we were taking a look at the place, and this was towards the end of end of September, that there were definitely some mosquitoes in the area. There is a little bit of water standing. There's kind of a lull that does seem to have a bit of swampy ground.
Okay, good. And this is the perfect time of year to prevent problems this summer. So you need BTI. I'll give you the full name. It's Bacillus thuringiensis, and the strain is Israeliensis. But you don't need to know that. You've been to a hardware store and a home center, and you've seen the donut-shaped dunks to put in ponds.
I have seen those.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's BTI. That's a total natural substance. It's a naturally occurring soil-dwelling organism that, when added to water, female mosquitoes will still lay their eggs in the water, but the eggs cannot proceed to become adult mosquitoes. It's a larvicide. It prevents the larva from successfully turning into the adult stage. Now, the interesting thing, talking about this at this time of year, female mosquitoes are just now coming out of hibernation, looking for a blood meal, and looking to lay their first clutch of eggs. If they lay that clutch in water that's been treated with BTI, that wipes out that line. So instead of a female mosquito laying 100 eggs, 50 females coming out of that, and then before you know it, you got 10,000, you knock out that first panelist and the game is yours. So you have two choices. The BTI comes in two forms. Either those donut-shaped dunks, which are sometimes shaped like charcoal briquettes, or granules. So treat that swampy area. You want to start right now. And if you're using the dunks, you need to freshen it up every 30 days, maybe every 3 weeks. But if you're using the granules, you need to refresh it every week or so. But you're not going to be doing this the whole summer. You just want to knock out those first couple of generations. After that, yeah. There shouldn't be many, if any, female mosquitoes left on your property. If you don't give them any untreated water to breed in, there's no way they can survive.
Since we're talking about standing water, would it be good for me to maybe put out some buckets of that as well?
Exactly right. That's what we've been advocating for years, is BTI traps.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be as big as a bucket. It can be a cat food can. It can be a pint container from the deli or the supermarket. Fill it with water, put in some granules or a chunk of dunk, and surround your house with these things. The more you put out early in the season, the more you're going to knock out all the overwintering females. You do this religiously for like the first 2 months, and after that you can stop because you probably won't be seeing mosquitoes or getting bit near your house.
Perfect.
All right.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right. My pleasure. Good luck with your house, man.
All right. Thanks. I'll see you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Haverford Home and Garden Show on Sunday, April 15th, at the Bay Shore Center in Port Norris, New Jersey on Thursday evening, April 26th, at the Camden County Green Garden Fair in Cherry Hill on Saturday, May 5th, and at St. Paul's Episcopal Church's Environmental Fair in Exton, PA on Saturday, May 12th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with tips for tasty tomatoes and more of your tasty phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Smart Pots, makers of the Smart Pot and the Big Bag Bed, fabric containers for your performance container garden. Learn more about the features and benefits of the Smart Pot at smartpots.com. That's smartpots.com. And the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. What are the probable causes when a previously productive bed suddenly becomes barren? And as we enter the season of dreaming about tomatoes, should you be pruning the suckers on those plants after you start actually growing them? We'll answer those questions after we answer more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Jim. How are you, sir?
I am fine, despite the gloomy weather.
And where is Jim finding gloomy?
In Flemington, New Jersey.
All right. What can we do for Jim in the Garden State?
Mike, I've been using the same garden plot for about 25 years, and tomatoes are the ultimate crop. It's been doing well. I amend the soil heavily every spring with compost from a municipality about anywhere from 3 to 5 inches.
That's pretty good.
And And I've been doing well, except 2 years ago, the blight that takes the foliage and kills it came earlier than usual.
I'm going to stop you right there. Blight is a very specific term for some very specific tomato diseases. Now, you've already told us you're growing tomatoes in the same spot over and over again. So I'm going to suspect that you have, in New Jersey, verticillium wilt, which means that as the season progresses, the bottom leaves of your tomato plants turn yellow, the yellowing progresses up the plant. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, because blight actually affects the fruits and leaves terrible greasy marks on them and kills the plants sometimes within days. So you don't want a blight. Your wilt is probably the most common problem in tomato growing. Do you grow anything else in your garden?
Peppers.
And how much of the garden square footage is taken over by tomatoes every year?
Unfortunately, too much. Like most people, I grow too many tomatoes and the garden becomes a jungle. And I've tried to do less of that each year. But I would say about at least 75% of the garden is tomatoes.
And how do you support them, since you just used the word jungle?
I have those big Texas cages. They're rectangular.
Oh, okay. But you can't keep the plants inside them?
Oh, I can keep the plants inside, except I'm greedy and I plant too many plants, so they grow together. They begin to overlap.
Yes. First of all, you got too many tomatoes already, but I'm going to tell you right now, you're going to get better production with fewer plants. The issue that's going on here is a wilt that builds up in the soil. The first year you plant a tomato plant in site A, everything will go great. But there's a soil-borne organism that's being attracted to the roots of those plants. Year number two, you plant tomato plants in that exact same site A, and now the organism is breeding. It's manufacturing more of itself. There's more of it in the system, but you're not going to notice anything. By year three, however, if those roots are in that same spot, now there's a heavy concentration of verticillium in the soil at the beginning of the season, and it starts to interfere with the functionality of the plant, and you see that yellowing of the leaves beginning at the bottom and then proceeding up on the plant. Your garden must be very healthy with compost, because typically by year four or five, the plants just die by July, which yours are not, right?
Right.
So one thing I want you to do is plant fewer plants and have better airflow in between. It is worse if the roots of the tomato plants are touching. Your tomato plants should be each have a 2-foot footprint. That's 2 feet square for the plant and a foot of open space in between each plant. Now, you've obviously suffering from verticillium. What do you plant? Do you raise your own tomatoes? Do you buy starts?
I usually grow my tomatoes from seed.
And you've already started for the season?
No, because this year I was desperate. I decided that I'm not going to do that. I'll just get some advice from you and then buy plants in mid-May.
Okay, good, good. Okay, so your choices are two. One is you will seek out plants with the letters V and F after the variety name. These are generally hybrid varieties, and there's nothing wrong with them. It's not genetic engineering. Hybridization has been going on for untold centuries. But these have been bred to be resistant to both of the popular soil-borne wilts, verticillium in the north and fusarium as we move further south. And after the variety name, it will always have those letters, V and F. Now, it may have more letters than that. It may have VFNT. That's fine. But you want to get the letters V and F after the variety name. The wilt will still show up, but it should be reduced. Your other option is an old idea that's become new again, which is grafted tomatoes. This way you can grow any type of variety you want, but that variety has been grafted onto a rootstock that produces really poor tomatoes, but resists verticillium wilt like nobody's business. And you're not going to get the tomatoes from the rootstock. Your tomatoes are going to come from the plant that's been grafted onto it. So you're not going to find these at a big box store, but at a specialty garden center or by mail order, you can get grafted tomatoes. The only disadvantage to grafted tomatoes is you can't bury the plants deep like you typically would tomatoes. You have to keep that graft line above the soil line. That's with any grafted plant. The graft can never be covered. So the VF varieties would help you out considerably, but I think you'd see a significant difference with grafted varieties. Eventually, you're going to have to build a new plot somewhere so you can rotate, but that should get you through the next season or two.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I enjoy your show. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Vicki, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
I am just fine today, Miss Vicki. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Sore after working in the yard the last 2 days.
Oh, you're making me jealous. I can't work in my yard right now. The ground is still frozen. Where are you, Vic?
The middle eastern part of North Carolina.
A little bit of heaven, huh?
Yes.
All right. What can we do for you?
I have two gardenia bushes that I rooted from my mama's plant, and they're like 14 years old. And on January the 5th, we had a horrible snow and 5 days of 5-degree weather. And now they're half black. Some of the leaves are brownish color. And I know they got burned bad by the freeze.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I know you're supposed to prune them in February.
I would never advise that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, even in North Carolina, you can still get freezing weather after February.
Yes.
So pruning stimulates growth. You wake up the plant early. It starts growing new growth again. It's expending energy, and then it gets frozen. That could be deadly for the plant.
Okay.
I hope that you haven't pruned them yet.
No, I haven't done anything because they look so horrible. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. They're about 3.5 feet high, and I didn't know how much I should cut back.
Good.
They got hurt pretty bad.
Yeah, but you have not delivered the killing blow, and congratulations to you. A lot of gardeners, when they see something like this, they go out and they panic or they can't stand the sight of it, and they go out and hack away, and that takes away the last chance the plant had. What I want you to do is wait. The hardest thing for a gardener to do, but always the best thing for the plant. Have you seen any new growth on these bushes?
No.
Okay. And it's not late for that. Hardy gardenias are not necessarily like the best plants to go through a freeze like this. It certainly wouldn't kill a fig root or anything like that. But right now, your best chance is to wait until you see new green growth appear. Now, you in North Carolina at this point are out of the frost season. So wait for new growth to appear. If new growth doesn't appear, there's very little you can do. But I will tell you what it is, too. Mostly, I want you to wait. Let's hope that new growth appears. And then I want you to mark your calendar for 2 weeks after that. Let the new growth come out. Let it establish itself. Let it show you which parts of the plant are dead and which parts are alive. And then feel free to go in and cut away the dead parts.
Okay.
They may not look real good this year, but if you get good green growth and you prune off the dead material, it'll be like having a 2 or 3 year old plant again. It'll take a little bit to get established and formed,
yeah,
but they'll still be alive. Now, if new growth doesn't appear on its own, beginning June 1st, I want you to go out and give the plants a light haircut. Just cut the worst 6 inches off every branch that you can see. Wait a week. See if that stimulates anything. And keep doing that until we get to the end of July. If you don't have anything by then I'm afraid the roots froze completely and the plants are dead. The best option is to wait until new growth appears on its own, prune 2 weeks after that. But if not, as I said, when you get to June 1st, start pruning them. See if you can stimulate some new growth. Don't put any chemical fertilizer of any kind near them. Don't mulch them or anything. You could spread, if you can find it, an inch or two of good compost around the roots to give them some gentle nutrition. But don't use any chemical fertilizer. You could burn them.
No, either. I don't. I use organic everything.
Good. Okay, well, we'll light a candle for your gardenias. Only time will tell.
Okay, thank you, Mike. I appreciate it so much.
All right, I really wish you luck here, Vic.
Yeah, thanks, and I just love your program.
Oh, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care.
1-888-346-9499. Larry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks.
Thank you, Larry. Where are you, man?
I'm actually in Greensboro, North Carolina this week, but I live in Quakertown.
That's a heck of a commute.
Yeah, it sure is.
Quakertown is just in between the Lehigh Valley and Philadelphia. What can we do for Larry in the former home of the Quakers?
Yeah, so I have a black cherry. It's about, I don't know, 20 or feet tall or so. It's about a 12-year-old tree, and it's about 20 or 30 feet from our trench-style septic, you know, drain field. And I'm a little concerned about the roots. You know, the tree we planted as a seedling about, you know, a foot tall. And, you know, it's grown up quite a bit, and I'm worried about our, you know, the drain field. And I'm wondering if, you know, that tree should come down or if it's, you think it might be far enough away.
Well, I am no expert. We have done a lot of research on septic field plantings over the years. One thing I can tell you is if you could go back in your Wayback Machine, you could have planted some dwarf or semi-dwarf fruit trees, but I don't think there is anything such as a dwarf cherry. I think they're all standard-sized trees, and they get really huge. Now, you say a trench-style field, and that kind of confuses me. Most systems are there's a tank in the ground, and when the tank gets too full, the liquid goes into a series of tubes that runs off into the drain field.
Yep. It's a gravity-fed drain field. It's not a sand mound.
But did you know the edge? Did you know the true edge of the furthest pipe?
Yes, we do.
And that's how far from the center of the tree?
Like I said, it's about 20 to 30 feet from the center of the tree.
The roots of a tree will typically, but not always, go out about as far as the furthest branch.
Okay.
So that means as the tree grows taller and wider, the roots will extend out further. And I don't think you need Professor Einstein here to tell you that they love growing towards that nutrient-rich water.
Yep.
So how often do you get your tank? And here we're really into the country living, folks. How often do you get your tank pumped?
We do it every 3 years.
Every 3 years. And when are you due for the honey truck to come by?
I think we're at least a year, maybe two out. We had it done recently.
And when you had it done, did you ask this question of the septic professional, the honey dipper himself?
No, I haven't asked him yet.
Because they are the ones who get the calls when fields need to be repaired. I don't think of cherry trees as having invasive or dangerous or aggressive roots. But, boy, that's a mighty tempting buffet you got right outside the root system there, Lar. So there's two ways that this could play. One is that the tree is actually going to function well to help the drain field stay productive, so to speak. If it clogs up a couple of holes and all these pipes that come out, I think that would be balanced out by the nutrients and water the tree would be soaking up. Is there a lawn over top of the septic?
There is, yep.
And you keep it mowed?
Yes.
As you go into the season, keep an eye on the grass. If you see the grass starting to falter near the tree, that could be a sign that the tubes are starting to get clogged with root hairs. But do you know how far the other side of the field goes to, the far side?
That one is a good 50, 60 feet.
Okay.
From the tree.
So theoretically, that one's never going to be impacted.
No, I wouldn't think so. I think it would be the first pipe would be the one.
Okay. Well, obviously, your two choices are to cut down the tree and leave the stump in the ground. You don't want to mess with the stump because then you would definitely damage your pipes. I would talk to the experts, so to speak, but I would also do watchful waiting. I would really make sure you let that grass get to be a good 4 inches tall before you cut it back to 3. If you never see that faltering, I think everything is okay. If you start to see the grass having trouble in that area, then you need to really get serious with the experts and consider cutting the tree down. And for anybody out there who's thinking about this, the cherries are perfectly safe to eat. There's no crossover. Well, people keep wondering about this. You know, are they going to get E. coli or something? And the answer is no.
Cool.
And one thing that you might want to consider is getting your tank pumped a little more often. Don't overload the drain field, and that'll give you even more protection.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Larry.
Great. Thanks, Mike. I enjoy your show, and I try and listen as often as I can, so I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I am gearing up to head out west and appear at the historic Sunflower Theater in Cortez, Colorado at 5 o'clock on Saturday, May 19th. Now, tickets are free, but you have to register in advance. And if we get enough requests, I'm prepared to do a second show that evening. But don't go clicking the links to secure your tickets at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the truth about tomato pruning, the curious case of the unproductive bed, and more of your unproductive phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And Smart Pots, makers of the Smart Pot and the Big Bag Bed, fabric containers for your performance container garden. Learn more about the features and benefits of the Smart Pot at smartpots.com. That's smartpots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Should you ever prune the suckers on a tomato plant? And as a special added bonus, what could be happening when a once productive bed falls out of production? We'll tell you what we think about both questions after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kevin, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am just ducky. Thank you. Where's Kevin Good?
I'm calling from Yardley, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, I'm calling because I took your advice a few years ago. A caller had talked about weeds in her grass, which is mostly what my lawn is.
Mm-hmm.
So I've let the violets go, and I've got naturalized crocus and lots of clover.
Mm-hmm.
I tend not to mow the grass until late in the season so that I'm not cutting down the crocus leaves. And I think what's happening is I've got some underground bees that come up. They love the clover. And I just want to make sure that I'm not harming them in any way because they seem to really like the lawnmower.
I'm so happy you called because this is the perfect time of year to explain a really significant difference to people. Especially in the early spring, in many lawns and in many plots of ground across North America will appear ground nesting bees. These are native bees. They don't have stingers. They're amazing pollinators. They do hover over the lawn or over the soil. They're not only harmless, they're incredibly productive. And people might call them digger bees or ground bees or something like that. But it's a huge family. There's probably 50 species that are ground nesters, mostly in the spring. And you can mow. You're not going to harm them. It would be nice to mow when they're not active, but you also don't want to mow when it's wet or anything like that.
Right.
So if you get a cool day, it'll be more productive for them. However, once we get into July and August, insects that look like bees coming out of a hole in the lawn could be aggressive yellow jackets. This is a member of the wasp and hornet family. It's the most aggressive wasp and hornet in North America. They do sting. They like to sting. They sting repeatedly. And when you are stung by a yellow jacket, you've been injected with a pheromone that draws more yellow jackets to you. So they are incredibly dangerous. Every year in North America, there's about 20 or 30 bee sting deaths reported. I'm convinced that every single one of these is a yellow jacket attack and that no bees were ever involved. So when do you see your ground nesting bees?
They're definitely in the spring. And they're very docile.
Yes, okay.
I mean, yeah.
Then you are right to be kind to them. They are improving the rest of your landscape dramatically. They're fun to watch. I mean, you can, you know, really even pluck them out of the air with no danger of being stung. One of the most interesting, after you mow, if you can see into their little holes, one of the most famous native bees is known as the polyester bee. Because if you look inside the hole, you can see that the female has lined the sides of the hole with a kind of plastic-like material that she's produced from her body to keep it nice and warm and dry inside.
Interesting.
And again, these bees are better pollinators of plants like squash and pumpkins than any honeybee ever will. They're tremendous pollinators of flowers, fruit trees, and they're active in the spring when honeybees are still maybe trying to get out of their hive and get healthy again. So they're a tremendous natural resource. And really, I think you can coexist with them and still mow the lawn a couple of times a year. Just common sense. If you see them being really active on a hot and sunny day, wait until the sun goes down because they're going to go underground when the sun goes down. And if it's still a nice day, perfectly good time to mow the lawn, better than in the morning or the heat of the day.
Sure. Okay, great.
All right, man?
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for taking care of the bees, Kev. They're some of my favorite creatures out there.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Good luck, man.
Thanks.
1-888-346-9499. Ariana, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Ariana. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Just ducky, thanks. Where is Ariana doing well?
In Point Breeze, Philadelphia.
Point Breeze. Help me out. I'm not sure. Where are we talking about?
Like west abroad between Washington and Snyder.
So you're in South Philly.
It's South Philly, yeah, but I figured I'd get a little narrow for you.
Okay. All right. What can we do for Ariana in Point Breeze?
Okay, so I have two things. One, they've been doing a lot of construction on my block, and last summer, a bunch of the brick dust and stuff from gutting different older builds got into my containers, and it started to sort of, like, water would pool at the top, and then it kind of got, like, green and white and like moldy algae-y looking. And I scraped the top layer off and then it started to actually drain and water wouldn't pool anymore. But I was wondering if the soil underneath, after going through the winter and water kind of washing all of that business through in the ones that I didn't clean very well, if that soil was safe for vegetables or if I should just stick with throwing some lavender in it or something.
Well, you lucked out because the danger, as I'm sure you realize, there's not only mortar and brick dust in there, but there's possible lead from the paint on the inside of the house. Anytime you're in a heavily urban situation like you, you assume that anytime a house is demolished, there's asbestos and lead to be dealt with. The asbestos, they're getting better at cleaning out ahead of time, but the lead is in the walls, it's in the paint, it's probably in the bricks from old leaded cars. People misunderstand the dangers of lead contamination. Yeah, some plants take up little bits of lead and some plants don't, but that's not the danger. The danger is humans touching and inhaling the dust that has a significant amount of lead in it. The fact that you let it alone until it turned into a slurry meant that you weren't exposed to any real dust. Now, you could have picked some up through your hands if you weren't wearing gloves. One reason I always urge people to wear gloves. But if you got all the debris off the top and you're back down to the containerized soil you used, you've removed the danger. And an amazing amount of mortar from in between the bricks must have gotten into your pots because it almost seemed like they were getting cemented over.
Yeah, it was the house directly next door to mine, and I had really nice southwest-facing sun out there, so I had a lot of stuff out there.
So anytime something like this happens, you want to wear a dust mask, you want to wear gloves, and you want to clean up all the powder, anything that came on your property, or really somebody should be responsible for doing that. There should never be any kind of debris overflow into an adjoining property. It's totally illegal, even in Philly.
Good to know.
Okay, what else?
So I have this huge Virginia creeper coming out. There's an empty lot next door that used to be a pretty large building. And there's a bunch of cinder blocks and stuff. And this thing is just like woven all through the cinder blocks. There was like a carpet that someone had dumped in the alleyway prior to my moving into that place. And the cords coming over the last little bit of structure for the building are like an inch and a half, 2 inches thick.
Mm-hmm.
I managed to cut through with some shears and get the carpet out of the alleyway and all that stuff up.
Urban gardening at its finest.
Yeah. but this plant like already has aphids on it. It's like it's gnarly, and I don't want creeper growing into my yard because I have a dog and the berries are poisonous.
Virginia creeper is a native plant that is often found on the exterior building. Sometimes in a college, you have to get close. What looks to be an ivy-covered building is actually Virginia creeper, which is a native plant. Anyway, what you want to do, I really can't necessarily visualize where it's coming from and where your property is, but the only thing you can do is install edging to keep it from getting into your garden beds. And then if there's a mother plant in an abandoned lot next door, if you can find where the root system is, you can just go over there. You can go to the grocery store every week, buy a couple of gallons of straight white vinegar, just 5% vinegar. And then if you can establish where the root system is, just dump a gallon a day of vinegar during hot and dry weather over where the root system is. That way you're not spraying it, so there's no danger to rise. You don't need protective material. But if you do that over the course of a summer, you can probably kill the root. Otherwise, you want deep edging to keep it out of your garden beds. And then if there's like a middle ground where it grows across an open space, just go back to the other side of the lot and cut the vines once or twice a year. The stuff that's on your side will simply die. It won't regrow. And if you keep up with the vinegar for a solid summer, and we get a hot, dry summer, I bet you can kill the root of that plant.
Cool.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, good luck with your urban adventure here.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, it's time for the question of the week, which I was going to call Two Tomatoes Walk Into a Bar, but I've been told I have to behave today, so it's Tomato Season Update, Pruning Suckers and Poor Production. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read this week's question.
You know, I was kind of looking forward to the original title. Oh, well. All right, moving on to Hank and Ambler, PA, who writes, I'm getting my garden plans together and was wondering if you recommend pruning the shoots that grow from leaf nodes on tomatoes. I've heard that it will limit production, but allow better circulation of air and may help with fungus issues. What's your feeling about this?
My feeling is that this is the first time anybody has ever suggested a logical reason for pruning tomato plants, instead of just believing that removing green leaves will somehow magically make more fruits appear.
But you always say that, quote, the suckers on tomato plants are the people doing the pruning. Have you changed your mind?
No, I've never removed a healthy leaf from a tomato plant, but this issue of airflow is a legitimate one. However, I like old-fashioned airflow. You'll always get more tomatoes by spacing them a little further apart than you might like. Specifically, a 2-square-foot footprint for each plant with a good foot of open space in between each one.
This is where your famous tomato cage design comes in really handy, as it confines even the most rampant varieties to an area that's 2 square feet. But what does it mean for airflow when a 12-foot-high heirloom is curled up inside a 5- or 6-foot-high cage?
Look, I came to this issue all too personally after I bought Snow White's old house in the woods. It is nice when the chipmunks and birds come in to help with the dishes, but the abundant trees that come along with that are not kind to sun-loving plants. And I have consistently found that space between plants is the best disease prevention strategy, even if the area is shady and or the individual plants are a little crowded.
So, no pruning?
Certainly not on determinate varieties, those well-behaved types that top out at 5 or 6 feet high. They need every leaf to keep good flavor in the picture. Now, with indeterminate varieties, those ill-mannered but incredibly tasty types that grow on never-ending vines, no pruning healthy leaves.
Okay, so you're holding firm.
Yes, but you should remove every discolored leaf immediately.
Because it's no longer photosynthesizing and it could be diseased.
Yeah. More important is that your garden is going to look better than your neighbor's gardens and make them jealous. They're not going to realize you have 30% fewer leaves than they do, just that you don't have any nasty-looking ones.
You are incorrigible.
It is not enough to succeed. Others must fail. Next question.
Rick, a professor emeritus at the prestigious Webb Institute in Glen Cove, New York, writes, we have 2 4x4 raised beds built over hard pan, 1 4 inches deep and 1 6 inches deep. The first year we grew tomatoes, peppers, onions, and radishes, and they all did well. The second year we let the soil rest after adding some organic compost. Last year, third year overall, we added more compost and tried tomatoes, peppers, and onions. Onions did okay, but very limited success with the tomatoes and peppers. Is there anything we can do to these beds short of replacing all the soil to have a productive season?
Well, a 6-inch-high raised bed is better than flat earth, but 12 inches is much better. However, several other factors are kind of crying out to me here. The professor says that peppers and tomatoes did well the first year, when those beds were probably the shortest in height. Then he added what is clearly purchased compost 2 years in a row, and now the tomatoes and peppers are suddenly doing poorly?
You suspect the soil?
It is the most obvious suspect. I want the prof to put some of that soil into containers designed for growing plants and plant some pea and or bean seeds in each one right now, indoors. Even inside, without artificial light, the young sprouts should initially be green and look well formed. If they emerge light in color, off color, or stunted, then the odds are good that his compost was contaminated with herbicides.
Tough darts. Modern herbicides can persist in contaminated soil or compost for years.
Bad darts indeed, but at least he wouldn't waste another season growing in that bad soil. And the answer to the obvious follow-up question is to build new beds nearby and fill them with compost that passes what we always call the duck test. It should look like rich black soil. It should smell a little earthy, but not sweet or sour. And it should feel like good soil. And of course, it should also pass the at-home herbicide test.
Which you are cleverly reminding people of just at the time they might be gearing up to buy bulk compost or topsoil for this season.
I think that's the first time you ever called me clever. Anyway, the other possibility is too few hours of sunlight. Onions are reportedly growing well there, and they're a root crop, which can get by with many fewer hours. But fruiting plants like tomatoes and peppers need a solid 6 and preferably 8 hours of direct sun a day, especially in northern locations like his New York area, where the season is short and somewhat chilly. Well, those sure were some interesting ideas about growing luscious love apples, now wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with access to lots of other great tomato growing info, click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to prune my prudence purples if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org. where you'll find the answers to all those garden questions you were going to ask us, audio this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our vice president of production is Terry Murray. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Webmasters Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website productive. Our associate producer of Production Association is Brett Rader. Unpruned Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, is fungus-free, we think. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I sure as heck ain't going to check. So I'll just hand out the blue books to test my compost for the season and see you again next week. Can you solarize a bed that's got a big tree in the middle? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how you can and can't use the rays of the sun to defeat weeds. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden.